Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly analysis of economic events, trends in our incomes, our debts, our jobs, future for our kids. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been an economics professor all of my adult life, and I teach currently at the New School University in New York City. I also write regular columns for truthout.org, a remarkable and courageous source of daily news and analysis. I really do urge you to take a look at truthout.org. Let me turn now to the larger topics that we have chosen for today. And again, to remind you, as we do, that these topics are chosen in good part because you've asked for them to be chosen. Here I want to express my thanks, before I do, to the blog of Kathleen Geyer, which I found to be particularly useful to talk about global inequality for a while with you today. Global inequality is measured by something called the Gini coefficient, G-I-N-I. And basically, that's a number that measures the distance between poor and rich in any society, the inequality of income. And here's some statistics that Kathleen Geyer brought together that I thought you would be interested, as I was, in thinking about. The two most unequal countries, that is, the two most countries inside of which inequality is the most extreme in terms of the gap between the lowest income and the highest, are South Africa and Brazil. Countries, by the way, in which there has been sharp and extreme conflict over inequality in the last year. Notice that correlation. The least unequal countries are the Scandinavians and two countries from Eastern Europe, Slovenia and the Czech Republic. And I'll let you think about why that might be. The most unequal regions of the world, the most unequal region, Latin America, where there are the most extreme. The least unequal, North America, Western Europe, Australia, and New Zealand. But there are exceptions. Russia, the United States, and China are exceptionally unequal when compared to other countries of their same level of development. Wow. Here's something interesting. From the Industrial Revolution, 18th century, through to World War II, global inequality worsened. That is, the gap in the world between rich countries and poor countries got worse. Now, I want to drive something home about this. The Industrial Revolution was also the beginning of the dominance of capitalism, first in Western Europe and eventually spreading to pretty much the whole world by World War II. In other words, the spread of capitalism was likewise the spread of global inequality. Capitalism and inequality go together, contrary to the propaganda that sometimes wants to make us believe that capitalism is some sort of equalizer. It has not been an equalizer. It has, in fact, gone together with global inequality between rich countries and poor countries. The inequality among them worse. But the inequality inside countries has. And so global inequality hasn't changed much. It's changed its shape, but not its overall condition of inequality. Inequality among nations hasn't gotten worse. But inequality inside nations has. We are therefore not a world that is suddenly encountering inequality. We are actually a world in which inequality has been a deepening problem, both across nations and more recently within nations. You will not be surprised, therefore, to learn that China produced more millionaires last year than the United States in terms of new millionaires. This is in a country where the extremes of wealth and poverty, therefore, have become more pronounced, even though the distance between China and the United States, for example, has become narrower. So these two, in a sense, offset each other. That is why I said we haven't gotten worse since World War II in the relationship between rich and poor countries, but we have gotten worse in the relationship inside countries in general between rich and poor. And so that is true in China, which is a rapidly growing society, and in Europe and North America, in which the economic growth, as we pointed out earlier today, has been much more modest. The second major issue I want to raise today, and we'll begin before taking our mid-program break, has to do with the notion of a guaranteed annual income. This is an idea that has been around for a long time. The notion that we might be better off, rather than providing countless specific programs, food stamps, housing subsidies, medical insurance subsidies, tax relief of one kind or another, if instead of that, we just said, look, let's guarantee to everybody in a society a certain minimum annual income that they will get by virtue of being a citizen of this country that will be enough to provide them with their basic needs of food, clothing, shelter, education, and so forth. Wouldn't that be more efficient? And wouldn't that be more socially beneficial? And this issue, which has been around a long time, has now gotten new urgency because of what has happened in Switzerland. And that process, which I've reported on once before, has now taken several new steps. First, the basic facts. Under Swiss law, if you can get 100,000 people to sign a petition, and remember, Switzerland is a small country, few million of population, so 100,000 is an enormous part of the population, circulated the petition for an annual national guaranteed income for all Swiss citizens, had to raise 100,000, they raised about 126,000 late last year, 2013, and that forces a ballot, a referendum, where all Swiss voters will be able to vote yes or no. It'll take some time, probably 2 or 3 years, to be put to a vote. They have that time to do that of $30,000 per person per year. And so I wanted to raise the question of what this would do and what are the pros, the cons, what is at stake in even thinking about such a thing and in the movement to it. Before I get to that, let me at least underscore what is crystal clear, which is that the Swiss people, like so many in other countries, are reacting against the extremes of wealth and poverty that have emerged. The very inequality I talked about a few minutes ago is showing up even inside such middle-class societies, such comfortable societies as Switzerland. The Swiss were outraged to discover the kinds of salary packages big corporations were giving themselves and their top executives. There were scandals about that earlier in 2013. It led to the past to rigidly control, much more than they could before, how high the salaries of executives would go. It led to the referendum on a maximum range between top and bottom payments, Swiss voters, but it was a clear sign of the extent to which the Swiss people are angry and are determined to do something about what they perceive to be a dangerous trend in modern capitalism, namely to produce extraordinary extremes of inequality. And these views of the Swiss citizens are simply a symbol, a sign of what is happening in other ways and expressed in other ways in so many other countries where the capitalist drive towards inequality is underway decades. The question is whether the problem of an gets at the problem, solves the problem, or perhaps to say it differently, what problems does a guaranteed annual income solve, and what problems does it leave in place? So let me first talk about the kind of obvious benefits it has. In almost all advanced capitalist countries, and indeed in many countries, the inability of the economic system to generate adequate standards of living for huge numbers of its people, either by the failure of capitalism to provide enough jobs or the failure of the economic system to spread the wealth in a fairly reasonable way so that the bottom half of the population can have a decent life, produces a patchwork of programs that are built up over time through complicated political maneuvers and compromises. So you have a program that provides food subsidies, or a program that provides emergency medical care, or a program that helps with school fees, or a program that gives retirement benefits. A whole host of programs designed to redistribute the income and the wealth in society, to compensate for what capitalism does to the mass of people by giving them some sort of support, and to take away from the richest some of the enormous wealth and income they have taken for themselves in order to care for those at the bottom. And by the way, the old debate is, of course, always going on between those who argue that this is humane and those who argue that whether or not it's humane, if the rich want to hold on to their wealth, they better pay something to take care of those at the bottom, because if they make the lives of those at the bottom too awful, there will be a movement to take the wealth away from those who have it. And then, of course, there are those who say, no, we don't have to do that. We need not do that. Maybe we even shouldn't do that. And you get the kind of stretch arguments that suggest that by keeping large numbers of people poor, you provide some bizarre incentive for them to do something, which, of course, the long history of poverty makes ridiculous. But nonetheless, these debates continue. So, and the programs are the results of these debates. So, of course, it is monumentally inefficient. And one of the arguments for a guaranteed annual income is that if we did that, we would do away with the vast waste of money, time, resources devoted to administering and checking and monitoring and inspecting 50 different programs, none of which would be necessary if we simply gave a certain minimum income to these people and then let them spend it as they need to for their food, clothing, shelter, medical care, education, and so on. So there's a kind of argument from efficiency, an argument from simplicity, an argument for getting rid of wildly excessive government bureaucracy to do something that could and should be done much more simply and much more efficiently. There's even an argument that it's more decent. That is, instead of making individuals come and ask for, beg for help with this problem, that problem, give them a decent income so they don't have to be humiliated by coming for each and every expenditure, because they've basically got the money to go out there and buy what they need, when they need it, and for themselves. That argument clearly has some merit, and that's probably how it's going to be fought out in Switzerland. I want to raise a different kind of question about the whole idea. While I understand and sympathize, of course, with those who are horrified by the level of inequality we now tolerate, by the side-by-side existence of extraordinary, if not obscene, wealth with mass deprivation and poverty. While we can see the growth of the appeal that this is wrong and inappropriate, not just in Switzerland, but the obvious effort of the new mayor of New York City, William de Blasio, to say that he's going to do something about the fact that New York City, in large parts of itself, has become unaffordable to anybody who isn't rich, that the level of rents that are being charged or home prices or condo prices that are being charged make the city a place for wealthy people, period. Or if you want to go to the other extreme, that in the city of extraordinary wealth, there are also, for example, in the borough known as the Bronx, unspeakable poverty, literally a stone's throw from unspeakable wealth, that this is not the way a city ought to be. This is not the way economic development ought to a course that is so supplication. So we see an opposition to this inequality all over the place, and I sympathize with it. But my quarrel, my question for those interested in a guaranteed annual income is this. Are you not dealing here with an opposition to the result or the symptom without dealing with the underlying cause, the underlying problem, the underlying disease, if we stay with the medical metaphor? Here's what I mean. You have an economic system that is organized in such a way that in enterprise after enterprise, a large do the work. 9 to 5, 5 days a week, they come and they do the work. Their muscle, their brains put together a product, a good or a service, for the employer who hires them, who then sells the product. The employer pays the workers their wages and gathers into his own hands the profit, the difference between the value of what those workers have created and what it costs the employers to get them to come there to create it. The profits have been growing. That's how capitalism works. The employer has every incentive to minimize the costs of production and every incentive to maximize how much he can get for it. And the gap between what he gets and what it costs is his profit. So you have a system driven to maximize the profits. This system has worked well and produced stunning profits for the employer class, the shareholders, and others who gather into their hands these profits. If you do nothing about that system, you're leaving in place the system that produces inequality. And then if what you do is tax those at the top to create the money that can then be parceled out to offset the inequality by helping middle and lower income people with their housing or their education or their medical care, whatever it is, this is a very strange way of solving a problem. As with a doctor who says, this is a symptom, I've got to go to the underlying problem, so it is with an economic analysis. You don't just deal with the symbol, the end result, the unequal society. You deal with the economic structure that produces such inequality. You've got to do something about this issue of profit. Who gets the profit? And what do they do with it? If all the workers together, as I say so often on this program, if all of the workers who together produced the profit were together to decide what to do with it, they, of course, wouldn't distribute tiny number of people all of it or most of it and create absurd wealth. They wouldn't do it. They would distribute it much more equally. Then we wouldn't have the problem. Right? We wouldn't have the problem. One of the things they could decide to do is to find useful work for all the people that are unemployed, because that's the logic, and nobody wants there to be unemployment anyway. Right? These are not complex ideas when you get to the basics of it. Moreover, if you don't, if you continue, even with a guaranteed income, what will you have done? You're going to create a guaranteed income that will have to tax the rich, or the middle to take care of all those who otherwise wouldn't earn an income. That's going to make for tensions on the part of the middle and particularly the rich. The rich are going to use their wealth to evade, weaken, and undo the guaranteed income. How do I know that? Because that's what they've done with every other program that was ever developed. That's why we're now discussing cutting Social Security. That's why we're now discussing cutting the people who have it use their wealth to prevent it being taken from the others. You've left in place the economic system that produces the unequal wealth that will forever resist and undermine whatever social welfare program you have, whether it's the patchwork quilt system we now have or the guaranteed minimum income alternative that is being considered in Switzerland and is being debated more widely, particularly in Europe. Why do this? Why plague a society with all the conflicts of redistributing income when you could get rid of all of that by simply distributing it differently from the beginning? Don't allow some people to have more than five, six, seven times what other people get. That's a big enough gap. More than enough. It's enough to recognize if you believe some people are more skilled than others, some people are more important to support than others. Whatever view you have, let it be understood that you single out, you reward, whatever word you like, those who you think ought to be rewarded more, but you limit the amount of difference so we don't have a society of extremes and all of the social conflicts and tensions. That we don't have a society that makes some people so rich and others so abjectly despondent that we have to have either an immense bureaucracy to offset this inequality or a guaranteed income that then becomes the object of endless maneuver and struggle and tension and waste of energy and waste of resources and undermining of whatever community spirit we can hope to hold our societies together. That's the ultimate question, and that is not addressed by the notion of a guaranteed annual income. We have, unfortunately, again, run out of time for this program. I hope again that you have found it of interest for to develop economic literacy, let's call it economic insights, by providing these regular updates will be a way for the real goal of this program to be reached. That all of you, dear listeners and viewers, that you understand that the economic crisis is here for the long term, and that what has to be done is a movement has to be built, organizations have to be built, that question and transform this economic system as the precondition for solving most of our social problems. It's a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to speaking with you again. Change, change, change. Change, change, change. Thing gonna change. Yes, it is.
KBOO Portland. Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary at 10:15. Stay tuned for Flashpoints. Talk about people in West Virginia drinking the water. Also, an ongoing efforts to indict former Haitian President Aristide on trumped-up murder charges. And at 11 o'clock, we have the Recovery Zone with host Stephanie Potter talking about how to talk about climate change. And thank you, KBOO members, for your great support. We're going to get right to Air Cascadia momentarily. Thanks for tuning in today.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, January. KBOO.FM on the web. And a lot of stuff going on today. A lot of news from around the region. Davos, Switzerland, of course, the wealthiest in the world, are meeting to discuss what's going to happen to the rest of us and how they're going to be able to pull out of it. Only this time, it's different. There are situations, notably Syria, also talks going on in Switzerland, that don't seem to lend themselves to the usual solutions. Furthermore, in Davos, the top issue on the agenda this time around is catastrophic climate change. And of course, what the Davosians are concerned about is, as always, the bottom line and what will happen to their portfolios. That's probably their only concern. The usual suspects will show up and voice their issues, but those voices are rarely heard by their intended listeners. It's generally only on stations like this that you do hear about these issues. We have a full agenda today. Let's get into it. Yesterday, Floyd Jones and Kent Crayford, the reservoir protectors for Oregon, the water guardians, delivered more than 50,000 signatures in support of the Portland Public Water District to City Hall. They need around 30,000 was the tipping point. Those have to be valid. The 50,000, I believe, have not been checked yet. But it seems an absolute shoe-in that the measure will make it onto the May primary election ballot. And TriMet and Portland Public Schools are still duking it out to negotiate new contracts with their employees. The Portland City Council is scheduled to ratify two new contracts with different unions today. Unions everywhere across the Cascadia region have been flexing a little muscle. And as always, those under our current local government are fighting back in strange ways, because of course it's always important to be re-elected in many of these